You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. There are corporate sponsors for stadiums, events, maybe even certain programs on college campuses. But what about K through 12 schools? Some districts in Wisconsin are warming up to the idea. We'll learn about how it works coming up. First, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says alcohol is at least partly to blame for the deaths of 88,000 people each year in the United States. There are a number of solutions out there aimed at bringing that number down, things like raising the alcohol tax, restricting sales, and creating stiffer penalties for drunken driving. Problem is that there are significant roadblocks to nearly all of them. Jeremy Arney is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. He studies alcohol policy here in the state. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, we're talking a lot about alcohol in Wisconsin over this couple of weeks. What are your thoughts on why Wisconsin has a problem with alcohol?
It's just, you know, you've probably heard this over the last 2 weeks on your program. It's the culture, the alcohol culture in Wisconsin, and it's you can see it politically, you can see it locally, you can see it every day, and it seems to be in the back of people's minds but never on the forefront. So I think that we haven't had the political will so far to address alcohol issues, and especially in your opening talking about stricter OWI laws and increasing the beer tax.
Let's talk about that beer tax. You were on with us some years back and made the case. So right now, you buy alcohol in Wisconsin, it's subject to the state's 5% sales tax. And then there's an excise tax per gallon. Beer right now, it's different for beer, wine, and alcohol. Right now, if I'm reading the latest data, it's 6 cents a gallon, putting us, I think, second lowest in the country. Talk about our beer tax.
Yes. So speaking of the political will, it's been 50 years since we've increased the beer tax. And you just mentioned it's the second lowest in the country. We're always complaining about the condition of our roads, more money for schools, and 'tis the season for budgets these days. And the beer tax would be a perfect example of it makes sense to increase it so you can gain revenue and then also give money for treatment and prevention programs. But it just hasn't caught on, and it's just a really dead in the water policy solution here in this state.
Do beer taxes or alcohol taxes in general discourage people from drinking in the first place?
Yes. There's several studies that show that just a slight increase will decrease excess drinking behavior. It also decreases alcohol-related vehicle accidents, vehicle fatalities. It decreases disruptive behavior from college students. So there's several reasons why increase in beer tax would be a good policy solution here. But like I mentioned, the political part of it is really difficult.
Now, our excise tax for liquor is $3.25 per gallon, wine, 25 cents a gallon. Again, beer, 6 cents a gallon. If you got to move the slider yourself, where would you like to see the beer tax in the state?
Well, currently, it's at for just a bottle of beer, it's under a penny. So it's 0.6% of a cent. Compare that to Alaska, where their beer tax, state beer tax, is $1.21. So we got a lot of room that we could work with. The last time a legislator tried to introduce a beer tax increase, they wanted 2.4 cents to increase it all the way to 3 cents per bottle. I think that that's kind of ridiculously low, and I've been laughed at across the state sometimes because I say I just go with the whole dollar because look how much money we could make. We could make
– $1 per bottle.
$1 per bottle. We would make over $1 billion in revenue for that. But of course that gets laughed at. But going at it, trying to expend all these political resources to just increase it by 3 cents or a nickel, or the local taverns aren't going to increase their pints by 3 cents or a nickel. They're going to probably go a quarter. So at least try to reach for something like that, a quarter or 50 cents. That's what I would implement.
Jeremy Arney is with us from UW-La Crosse talking about alcohol policy here in the state, what might help to reduce harmful drinking here in the state. Jeremy, do you see in the realm of the possible a change that Wisconsin could make maybe this go-round?
Well, this go-around in the legislative
yeah.
session? No. I see all pro alcohol industry, all pro drinking bills that are being put into place. I do not see the OWI issue getting more strict because it's a cost. And so that's what the opponents that haven't, you know, every year we try to make sure that our first offense for an OWI is more than just a traffic ticket, that it's actually a criminal offense. But that just seems to go nowhere because it costs a lot of money to enforce that type of policy solution. And we don't have the money to put more police officers on the roads, nor to give money to the district attorneys to prosecute these cases. So if we were going to enforce more stricter OWI laws, it's just a financial situation here.
How about ignition interlock devices? We talked to someone from Mothers Against Drunk Driving the other day. That was one of their big priorities for the state. Do you think expanded use of ignition interlocks is a possibility?
Yes. And once again, those should be – that's a cheap way for the state to implement a more strict policy when it comes to drinking and driving. So most of the cost is going to be placed on the person that drinks and drives, the violator. They're the ones that are going to have to pay for the ignition lock. And it seems like it seems a way to go, but I have not seen, and I just briefly looked at about a dozen different alcohol bills that are in place right now, and I haven't seen anything to do with interlock devices at all.
When it comes to the harm from alcohol, a lot of people might think of drunk driving, of course, the risks of binge drinking. One that may not get as much attention is falls among seniors mm-hmm. in Wisconsin. Do you see, and we have, we've talked about this on the show, we have more falls, more hazardous falls for seniors, a lot of evidence that's alcohol related. Do you have thoughts on solutions to that?
Yes. So in the last few years, the clinical and medical professions have been instituting this ESPERT thing, which is the screening, brief intervention, and referral for treatment. So that's the acronym ESPERT. And that has done a lot of positive things throughout the country, not just in Wisconsin, but it's evidence-based. And there was just a study that was done within a month ago that asked nurses in a community nursing home, you know, what are their attitudes towards binge drinking or heavy drinking by older people? And then they were given some education. And then after they were given that education, they actually went out and implemented these interventions. And just from that education itself, after the 3 months that they were trained, they actually reported 241 different interventions, something that they probably wouldn't have done without that education. So, and it is important, as you mentioned, about falls in Wisconsin, because we lead by far, and you've heard this probably on your program, by far the amount of falls by the elderly in the nation. And a lot of that's tied to overconsumption of alcohol.
We're talking about legislative and other efforts to cut down on problem drinking in Wisconsin. Jeremy Arney is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What alcohol-related policies would you like to see? Would you like to see the state legislature pass? How do you feel about the idea of raising the beer tax or putting limits on sales, availability, when and where you can buy alcohol? And how about penalties for drunk driving, first-time offenses? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the legislative options to reduce problem drinking in Wisconsin. Jeremy Arney is our guest, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. He also researches alcohol policy in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of changes would you like to see in Wisconsin to address the state's problems with alcohol, to reduce the harm from risky drinking? Do you think anything's going to change? What would you think about the beer tax going up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Jeremy, in a few minutes, we're going to hear a piece about how medical professionals are at risk of excessive drinking. Are you aware of any policies in place specifically to help maybe paramedics, surgeons, or other people in high-stress jobs like that?
No, and that was a great question that your producer brought up in the email that he sent me. I looked into, you know, I mentioned the ESPERT thing, and so we have professionals that are actually screening the general public and to make sure that they're not over-consuming, to put them in a treatment referral program. But that was a great question about what do you do for those that are providing that screening process that actually might have an alcohol issue themselves. And there's nothing that I could find policy-oriented-wise besides maybe going to the med schools and the nursing schools to address that issue up front right there. But once again, that the one study that I did find was in Canada dealing with the med students, and then there was a thing about doctors in the UK. But it's a really good question, and it's amazing, and I think that that stumps a lot of people. I had never thought of that myself, and just by perusing through the, you know, trying to do an initial research on it, there really isn't much. There was one study done that just talked about descriptively that police officers drink a lot, and so there you go. And then the males drink a little bit more than females, but they don't really go into, well, how do we help them? There's no policy solutions there. And so I think that there's that's an area that needs to be looked at for the caregivers need to be given some care themselves.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us at Spring Green. Jim, hi.
Hello. I have three ideas I'd like to put out there. Number one, we're the only industrialized country in Western civilization anyway that has a 21-year-old drinking age. Everybody else is 18 or 19, some as early as 16. And if we did that, we could still keep the not a drop law. I propose going to 19 to keep it out of high schools, expand the not a drop law to age 25, and have first offenders at any blood alcohol level get ignition interlock devices.
And the not a drop law, Jim, meaning no alcohol at all if you're driving?
Until you're 25. What do the car rental companies know that we don't know? You can't rent a car until you're 25. And then the last thing I would say is the idea of criminalizing the first offense, even though other states have misdemeanor status, hardly anybody goes to jail on a first offense. If your blood alcohol level isn't real high, if you cooperated and you agree to education programs, they don't impose jail terms in most places, including our neighboring states.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First of all, that idea, and we hear this often, Jeremy, lower the drinking age, and that's going to make less of a mystique about alcohol, I guess, for youth?
Yeah, that is probably not a good idea. Just physiologically, we have frontal lobes in our brains that don't fully develop until we're 25. So if we start drinking alcohol at an earlier age, those don't really get fully developed. That's just one issue I could come up with in terms of the drinking age. And already Wisconsin has an issue, and still on the books, where parents can bring their kids into the local taverns and they can drink with them too. I think we're one of two, if not the last state to be able to do that. And so I think we should address that before we lower the drinking age.
And then that idea of ignition interlock on the first offense.
I love that idea. That's a great idea. I think that Jim is spot on in Spring Green.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim. We'll go now to Steve Intrigo. Steve, hi.
Yeah, over the years, the issue of drunk driving in particular has solutions have focused on trying to get people to quit drinking, depending on their diagnosis following assessment and so forth. And I think not enough attention has been put on the expansion of mass transit, safe ride programs through the Tavern League, rural bus routes like we have up here in northern Wisconsin, obviously bus routes in places like Madison, Milwaukee, Eau Claire, Green Bay, so forth. And I think mass transit in particular would help the issue of drunk driving, and I'd just like to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Steve, thanks for the call. So transportation for people, say, getting home from the bar, among other things. What do you think, Jeremy?
The mass transit idea is great. Now, whether it's politically feasible, we've seen already we've tried to put in mass transit in certain areas and it just hasn't gotten the funding to do that. And here in La Crosse, we have something that people, the students asked for busing to go to the bars. So basically they call it the drunk bus. And so they get rides to and from the bars, and that has cut down on drinking and driving for sure. But then we should probably think about, are we catering to the young adults to be able to just take them there and then kind of encourage them to not be responsible in their drinking behavior because they don't have to? It's a kind of a cultural, political question that I find interesting. But I do think that increasing the availability of mass transit would help cut down on our drinking and driving.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Jeremy, at the outset, you said culture is part of the problem. You just mentioned it there as well. Are there things that can change that cultural attitude toward drinking?
So in the I studied the policies and the legislative aspect of it, and I am discouraged by what I see being put out there. There's, I've mentioned it before that if you try to increase a beer tax, then it's pretty much political suicide across the state because nobody's going to be interested in supporting you if you're going to increase their sacred drink, the blue-collar thing that they're going to be drinking every day after work for the whole year. Now, I am encouraged by what happens at the local level, and there are lots of things that people can do across the state in the communities because that's where you see you're more affiliated and you know when things happen and you know other people and you want to take care of them. And so I've been very encouraged over the last few years to see community-level efforts to address binge drinking, and I think that there's lots of good things that have been done for that. Like keg registrations and things like that. So it comes back if there's a party and someone gets injured, then whoever got the keg is going to be held responsible. Little things like that, open container laws. So local level ordinances can be used to trump the things that aren't encouraged or the lack of political will at the state legislative level.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jeremy Arney is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. We talked to him about various policy ideas to curb problem drinking in Wisconsin. Some of the people who work to care for others can have a hard time making sure that they get the care they need. Those in high-stress jobs like nursing may turn to alcohol to cope. Now the field of nursing is trying to help these helpers find ways to help themselves. WPR's Jenny Peek reported on the issue of alcohol abuse among nurses for our ongoing series, High Tolerance. Here she is talking to host Brady Carlson.
Some of the people who work to care for others can have a hard time making sure they get the care they need. Those in high-stress jobs, like nursing, may turn to alcohol to cope. And now the field of nursing is trying to help these helpers find ways to help themselves. WPR's Jenny Peek reported on the issue of alcohol abuse among nurses for our ongoing series, High Tolerance, and she joins me now with more. Jenny, let's start with the story of a nurse you met who says after these long, hard 12-hour shifts, she would start unwinding at the end of the day with a glass of wine. But then what happened?
I talked to a nurse named Ryan, and she was really open in telling her story that she worked in a job where she was kind of filling in the craziest portions of the hospital, seeing a lot of trauma, working 12-hour shifts, and she would get home and her adrenaline was just pumping. And she started relying on a glass of wine or two to calm down at the end of the day.
I don't know what light went off in my head, but part of it was like I realized that I was drinking every night that I got home. And like for Wisconsin, it wasn't a lot. It was like maybe two glasses of wine, but like I felt like I needed that wine. Like I needed a drink when I got home. And that's not a good way to live your life.
She ended up switching jobs. And this is fairly common for nurses that are super stressed. They go to a different part of the hospital. They go somewhere that is maybe more stable, less traumatic. And she also switched to nights, which for her just ended up working. She said it felt way too weird to drink when she got home in the morning. She said that alcoholism runs in her family, so it was something she was really conscious of.
There are two concepts you wrote about that are particular to nurses that make alcoholism of particular concern. One is known as compassion fatigue, and the other is the super nurse phenomenon.
Definitely. So first, I want to point to this 2016 study that measured the impact of stress and the ability to cope among nurses. It found that 90% of those surveyed had moderate to very high levels of stress, 78% of nurses slept less than 8 hours a night, and 22% were classified as binge drinkers. So that stress is clearly affecting them. Compassion fatigue is basically an indifference or inability to provide compassionate care because of the constant exposure to other people's pain and suffering, while sort of feeling powerless to make a difference. And this super nurse phenomenon that I mentioned is something Lindsay Stege, an associate professor at UW-Madison, wrote about. And she describes it as this mindset and stigma that basically shows that nurses can't seem weak at all, even though they're dealing with this really intense job. So it's a culture within the profession that you're not a real nurse if you haven't worked 12 hours without going to the bathroom or taking a break, or you're not a real nurse if you haven't worked 5 shifts in a row. And this mindset can make it so people don't ask for help. And this is something that Gina Denick Champion, the CEO of the Wisconsin Nursing Association, found as well.
We have our nursing code of ethics where we are responsible for our patients and for taking care of our profession, one another, as well as taking care of ourselves. And I think nurses from time to time will really fall short on taking care of themselves because we take care of everybody else first.
So what are nurses now trying to do so that people aren't trying to turn to alcohol abuse as a coping mechanism?
Yeah, so there are a lot of programs that offer wellness programs, yoga, meditation, having a gym in the hospital so that if they want to work out, they can do that. But a lot of experts point to starting with nurses in nursing school, teaching students right off the bat about the dangers of stress and what healthy coping mechanisms are, showing them that you can take a break or you don't have to work 12 hours in a row, and kind of break down that culture that that's okay, that doesn't mean that you're weak. Nurses are still extremely strong and they are super, but you can be a super nurse without hurting your health.
WPR's Jenny Peek, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brady.
You can look at all of WPR's reporting on alcohol in Wisconsin in our series High Tolerance. Find that at WPR.org/alcohol. Grafton High School will soon be playing its home basketball and volleyball games inside the Acuity Gymnasium. It's not a high-end special facility in the community. It's the same gym as before, but it now has a corporate sponsor. The Grafton School Board recently signed off on a 25-year agreement with Acuity Insurance worth $425,000. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this week that other school districts in southeastern Wisconsin have or are considering naming rights for school buildings, areas, facilities, and other property, though only a few have actually pursued such deals. Marguerite Rosa is the director of the Edunomics Lab and a research associate professor at Georgetown University. She specializes in school finance and spending. Marguerite, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this issue of various kinds of corporate sponsorship in schools, it's not a new idea, is it?
No, it's definitely not a new idea, and it's not unique to school districts. We see municipalities, higher education institutions, cities, counties doing the same kind of thing.
There's been extra concern when it comes to schools, though, because it's kids potentially being advertised to. What kind of objections do people often bring up when it comes to corporate sponsorships of facilities?
Well, I think the real objections come around if the advertising to kids is designed to get them the kids to start consuming our product more. So we saw this a lot. The discussion came up a lot around 20 years ago when fast food or, you know, sodas or things that kids would consume were advertised to them on the sides of school buses. And we generally don't see that anymore. I think the consensus is that if we're trying to sell something to the kids, then it doesn't belong in schools. There is a lot of naming of facilities that happens, and often with a local community partner who's trying to oftentimes, you know, do good by the way of the public schools and contribute in some way and be recognized for their contribution. I think we see a lot of that.
So in the one example we mentioned in a school here in Wisconsin, it's an insurance company. Presumably the high school kids aren't going to be flocking out of school to sign up for a policy.
Right, right. And in fact, when it's a local company, a lot of times that you have employees of the company who have spouses, sisters, brothers, et cetera, that are employed in the schools, and kids of employees that are in the schools. And the idea is they're trying to be a local partner there. That is what we typically see when we see these kinds of things.
Around the country, are you seeing school districts turning to some form of naming rights or sponsorships as a way of coping with concerns about funding shortfalls or reduced funding from their state governments?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're not seeing any more of a jump in that than any other time. I think it's, like I said, it's not unusual for districts to get creative. For years, we've seen districts sometimes charge fees for kids for lockers, or seek some kinds of donations or auctions, or have volunteers or partnerships or booster clubs or sponsors of uniforms, you name it, to kind of try to bring in some money on the margin. And it's generally money on the margin. You know, the school districts are spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $14,000 per pupil. And these kinds of arrangements, if you look at them, bring in, you know, basically change compared to that. And in view, the Acuity example you mentioned, a $425,000 contribution over 25 years, if you divide it out per pupil during the time of the gym, you're at $24 per student. And that is something that is relatively minimal compared to the $12,000 to $14,000 in public funds that the district is spending on behalf of the students.
Talking to Marguerite Rosa from the Edunomics Lab and Research Associate Professor at Georgetown University, talking about corporate sponsorships and schools, naming rights, and more. Do you often see it as a particular facility? The school has one substantial capital project, maybe a new sports facility or gym or something like that, that tends to get this kind of sponsorship?
Yes, it can be more in the nice to have kind of things. And the Acuity example is part of their capital plan. We see a lot of sponsors of the scoreboard at athletic facilities. That's so common across the country. And like a score, you know, a big electronic scoreboard might be a nice to have kind of item. We see places where, you know, the track field might be in not great condition, and yet it's not critical that it be replaced in a given year, and you might get a sponsor that does that. So those are the things. And we would recommend that if you are going to partner with an outside source of fund, a community source, that it be for a one-time or a capital expense versus a non-recurring expense, in part because, you know, you really can never count on that going forward. So you leave the public funds to do the operating costs and, you know, do bonds and other kinds of levies or community contributions to build the permanent structures.
And do you have recommendations for schools about screening the kinds of businesses who might do a sponsorship? This might be okay for a school setting, this other one might not be?
Well, we would suggest to engage with the community and be really transparent about that. You know, you want to put the contribution in per pupil terms to sort of figure out what amount of money are we talking about here? What, if anything, is asked in return? And then engage with the community and be really transparent about that. Like I said, one-time cost, non-recurring costs are better than trying to figure out how to support operating costs with these sort of partnerships. And generally, I think the standard is to avoid advertising directly to students. You don't want to have, you know, Red Bull bowl or junk food or something like that in the cafeteria that's trying to encourage students to consume products. And the more local, probably the better, because these local partnerships, these local investments and arrangements with communities do well for schools. I think not just in terms of bringing money, but in terms of those community relationships and those, schooling is a human business, right? It's very much about these relationships. It's less transactional than many other industries. And having community industries partner with schools tends to bring goodwill all around.
Now, how about in-kind corporate support? We're going to provide you with these materials for use in the classroom or technology or what have you. The students get to use it for free. Oh, but it's got our logo on it.
Yeah, I mean, again, I guess the question is, are you trying to sell a product that, you know, in the near term? But this can happen in all sorts of forms. You can see Apple computers, discounting the cost of computers to schools, thinking, well, if the kids are using Apples, you know, when they're in elementary school, maybe they'll keep using them for their whole life. And so that happens in lots of ways like that. I don't think you can buy a computer without a logo on it anyway. So I think that can happen. Again, if there are donations or contributions made, I think they should absolutely be on the up and up and very, very much communicated. What's one of the things we find is that school districts don't always do a great job about engaging with their public when it comes to money. We teach about that in our certificate program at Georgetown, how to build those skills. But the more communication, the more likely you are to have trust. And if there is some sensitivity around it, that'll come out when you're having very open discussions with your community about potential revenue sources.
We're talking about corporate sponsorship at K through 12 schools with Marguerite Rosa. She's director of the Edunomics Lab and a research associate professor at Georgetown University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of selling the naming rights for certain school facilities, maybe the football field, the gym, what have you, to local businesses? How about non-local businesses? Is it a good way for schools to help pay for projects like that? Or do you think it sends a bad message to kids? Where do you draw the line? What works for you? What doesn't? And what do you see in your community when you go into the school? When you go to the football game, basketball game, what do you see? Are you cool with it or does something bug you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about corporate sponsorships at schools. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that a few public schools in southeastern Wisconsin have pursued such agreements, and others are looking into the idea as a way in particular to fund facility projects. Well, what do you think of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. Is there a place for business sponsorships in K through 12 schools or not? If you're a school official yourself, is this an issue on your radar? Is this something that you've done to help do some kind of capital improvement? If you're a business owner, would you consider buying naming rights to a school facility in your area? And where do you draw the line? If you're a parent or a community member, what would be appropriate for a school? What is not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, on our Facebook page, we heard from a former state lawmaker, Therese Brousseau. She writes, "No to school sponsorships. We shouldn't teach that making money is the definition of success." And Marguerite, there are people out there who think, you know, no slippery slope here. We don't want any corporate sponsorship, business sponsorship in the schools. Is that a common sentiment across the country?
No, that isn't. I think in most communities, especially that might be common in more urban areas. But in many communities, you know, there are senses for the schools to maintain a really good relationship with their community. Next time there's some sort of bond initiative and the community votes on that, maybe we're trying to replace the roof on the main school or things like that, we want people to vote yes on those. And so we're not trying to be at odds, generally speaking, with local industries. Local industries often hire graduates, come in and volunteer in classrooms, teach classes and things like that. So I think the idea of, you know, setting up a barrier wall and not recognizing the real human connections there might be to a school district's detriment. At the same time, I would say that there's not as much money here as most people think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, the numbers can sound big, but when you're looking over the long haul, these are really small dollar amounts per pupil per year. And so if you're setting up your district to spend a ton of time with the staff trying to recruit these allocations, that may not be a good use of your time. Because they tend to be very small.
Let's bring on a caller now. Luke is with us in Milwaukee. Luke, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm more of the opinion if the direct beneficiaries of this would be the taxpayers that are paying for the kids to go to these schools, then by all means advertise as much as you want, as long as it gets kicked back to us.
Luke, thanks for the call. Again, it's not a lot of money being kicked back to taxpayers, but does this tend to relieve, in a place like Wisconsin, say, the property tax burden, Marguerite?
Generally not. I mean, the way it can happen is that a local initiative fails, so the voters vote no, and there's sort of a coming back to what is the minimum thing we need, or where can we try to work with community partners to get an industry contribution or sponsorship of something, and that allows us to not have to go back to our voters. So that can be an issue, but a lot of times capital improvements do fail at the ballot box, and you know, they're just put off for a few years. So maybe we're not going to redo the stadium right now, or we're not going to spruce up the gym. We're going to go another 2 or 3 years until the local economy turns around and people feel more inclined to vote yes. So I think though they're, you know, the relationship isn't a one-to-one with the dollars, and sometimes they'll just dip into the operating expenses, sort of the $12,000 to $14,000 that do come from public sources that are operating. You know, we maybe we'll figure out how we can replace the roof with those dollars.
Luke, thanks a lot for the call. Marguerite, have you run into school districts who think, given the limited amount of money involved, it may not be worth the effort to pursue these kind of deals?
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes there's the, you see the big number and then you haven't sort of realized that how big the rest of the district's budget is, and maybe this isn't worth our time. Like I said, a lot of this is about relationships with community and where school districts are thinking and working about those relationships or trying to ensure that they're being also a responsible partner in their community. And that way, when things go to the ballot, people tend to vote yes on them, but they feel like their district has been listening to them. And so I think we see a lot of that. But I don't think most district people think this is where the big money's coming from.
Setting aside the sponsorship, I want to hear more about community engagement in the schools. What are some of the recommendations you would have a school who hasn't had that community engagement mindset up to date?
Well, we've done actually a lot of research with some other partners on that issue. And one of the things we find over and over is that people want the chance to weigh in on how public funds are spent. And having a lot of communication and an opportunity and an authentic invitation to weigh in is a really good way to build trust with the community. And a lot of times school district leaders just don't quite have the skills to do that, or may not have had the practice, and might feel like it's extraneous. It's an extra burden that we have to put on ourselves. But it goes a long way, both with the community, but also with those in the schools. And we find that principals and teachers and parents and the larger community all want to weigh in and participate in conversations about how resources are allocated.
And I think some administrators might hear that and think, great, people get to yell at me more at school board meetings. What's a way to set up a good positive environment to do that?
Well, first of all, not letting them weigh in is a great way to get more yelling. So I think if they feel like they're not heard, that's going to happen. When we teach on this, as I mentioned, in our certificate at Georgetown on ed finance, and spend a lot of time sort of going over the research with folks that shows that if you're not invited to weigh in, the public is more likely to respond with anger. So the trust gets higher when there are more opportunities for this. And a lot more empathy comes if the district says, look, these are tough decisions. We've been trying to decide if we spend our money on X or Y, and here's the dollars that we have at hand, and these are limited resources, and we want to hear from the community about what matters most. And as we make our decisions, we want to hear from you all on how this plays out. And that kind of dialogue goes a long way to encourage trust in local school districts.
We'll leave it there for now. Marguerite, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Marguerite Rosa, director of the Edunomics Lab and a research associate professor at Georgetown University. She specializes in school finance and spending. We talked to her about school districts considering and in some cases turning to corporate sponsorships to help pay for projects and other items on their budgets. No one wants to be hungover, especially when they have to work. The most recent study available shows excessive drinking cost Wisconsin $6.8 billion in 2012. More than 40% of that was due to lost productivity. Danielle Kading reports on the challenges that workers and employers face when alcohol becomes a problem on the job.
Pastry chef Noreen Ovadia-Wills makes great food. She found out early on she could even do it while drinking when she worked for the owner of a bar and restaurant on Lake Superior's Madeline Island.
And he kept feeding me Bloody Marys, and I was really drunk. He's like, get back in there and cook. And I'm like, I can't. I'm too drunk. He goes, I can cook so drunk that I can't even stand up. Get in the kitchen.
Not every boss was like that, but Will says that was just part of restaurant culture. Work hard, get really sweaty, and go out drinking afterwards. She says she worked in every single restaurant on the island before her drinking made her unemployable. Now the recovering alcoholic owns a cafe in Washburn with her husband.
Order up!
It's been a long road to recovery for Wills. She recalls missing shifts, getting arrested several times, and losing custody of her daughter for a time. She says everything was about getting that next drink.
Barely struggling to get to work so that you can have money so you can feed your addiction is your main focus.
A 2015 national report shows the food service industry is among the top three with the highest rates of heavy alcohol use next to mining and construction. Dr. George Kube with the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism says it's no surprise excessive drinking can lead to problems on the job.
It doesn't take much of an imagination to realize that contributes to injuries, fatalities, absenteeism, hangovers. You're not at your best, so you're slower to work, you make more mistakes.
That's led some companies to offer programs to help employees struggling with alcohol. University of Georgia sociology professor Paul Roman says the foundation of those employee assistance programs is to improve their job performance.
Lots and lots of workers, male and female, the job is really central to their identity. And it may be enough of a shock or wake-up call that they're letting their behavior become sloppy and that they don't need to go to treatment.
Roman says employee assistance programs have great potential to help workers, but he questions whether they're effective for addressing alcohol. He says a lot of programs are provided by outside vendors that give people an 800 number to call where they may be referred to a handful of free counseling sessions.
If that isn't adequate, then they supposedly have to start paying these counselors if they want to get any more treatment. And that's it. That's all there is.
Marina London with the Employee Assistance Professional Association argues a good program has behavioral health professionals who provide confidential services to help connect people with the resources they need. But she says employers don't always do a good job letting people know help is available.
The company has to be behind the program. The program has to be of quality, and the employee has to be brave enough to ask for the help. And it takes courage to ask for help.
London says some may shy away from seeking help because of the stigma associated with substance abuse. Others may fear backlash from their employer or may not have health insurance. Noreen Ovadia-Wills says it never occurred to her to ask an employer for help because she wasn't ready to admit she needed it.
It helps to know where you can go for help when you need it. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean you're going to ask for it.
When Wills did reach out for help, it wasn't easy. She went to detox more than a dozen times and began going to recovery meetings. But now, Wills has gone from being unemployable to hiring others looking for a second chance. She's even driven employees to detox herself. She says it may seem crazy, but someone was crazy enough to give her a chance. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Find out more in our series, High Tolerance, looking at alcohol in Wisconsin. You can find all of our stories there at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a bunch of other stuff. In Congress, while the standoff between the president and House Democrats is getting headlines, we'll look at a long list of policy items on the table in the Senate and the House. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Indian-ish, about capturing the feel of Indian food, but not stressing out over getting all the details just right. And we'll meet two Wisconsin students going to a national spelling bee. Can they spell excited? I hope so, because that's a pretty easy word compared to a lot of the words they'll run into in a big spelling bee. Plus, we'll round up some of the most interesting stories from communities around Wisconsin. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.